wed your younger girl to Prince Tommen, and your heir to Marcella. It will be 4 years before Joffrey comes of age. By then, he will look to you as a second father. And if not, well, 4 years is a good long while, my lord. Long enough to dispose of Lord Stannis. Then should Joffrey prove troublesome, we can reveal his little secret and put Lord Renly on the throne. We? Ned repeated. Littlefinger gave a shrug. You'll need someone to share your burdens. I assure you my price would be modest. Your price? Ned's voice was ice. Lord Baelish, what you suggest is treason. Only if we lose. You forget, Ned told him. You forget John Arryn. You forget Jorry Cassell. And you forget this. He drew the dagger and laid it on the table between them. A length of dragon bone and Valyrian steel, as sharp as the difference between right and wrong, between true and false, between life and death. They sent a man to cut my son's throat, Lord Baelish. Littlefinger sighed. I fear I did forget, my lord. Pray forgive me. For a moment I did not remember that I was talking to a Stark. His mouth quirked. So it will be Stannis and war. It is not a choice. Stannis is the heir. Far be it from me to dispute the Lord Protector. What would you have of me, then? Not my wisdom, for a certainty. I shall do my best to forget your wisdom, Ned said, with distaste. I called you here to ask for the help you promised Catelyn. This is a perilous hour for all of us. Robert has named me protector, true enough, but in the eyes of the world, Joffrey is still his son and heir. The Queen has a dozen knights and 100 men-at-arms that will do whatever she commands, enough to overwhelm what remains of my own household guard. And for all I know, her brother Jaime may be riding for King's Landing even as we speak, with a Lannister host at his back. And you, without an army, Littlefinger toyed with a dagger on the table, turning it slowly with a finger. There is small love lost between Lord Renly and the Lannisters. Bronze Yon Royce, Sir Balon Swan, Sir Loras, Lady Tender, and the Red Wine Twins. Each of them has a retinue of knights and sworn swords here at court. Renly has 30 men in his personal guard, the rest even fewer. It is not enough. Even if I could be certain that all of them will choose to give me their allegiance, I must have the gold cloaks. The city watch is 2,000 strong, sworn to defend the castle, the city, and the king's peace. Ah, but when the queen proclaims one king and hand another, whose peace do they protect? Lord Petar flicked at the dagger with his finger, setting it spinning in place. Round and round it went, wobbling as it turned. When at last it slowed to a stop, the blade pointed at Littlefinger. "Why, there's your answer," he said, smiling. "They follow the man who pays them." He leaned back and looked Ned full in the face, his grey-green eyes bright with mockery. "You wear your honour like a suit of armour, Stark. You think it keeps you safe, but all it does is weigh you down and make it hard for you to move. Look at you now. You know why you summoned me here. You know what you want to ask me to do. You know it has to be done, but it's not honourable. So the words stick in your throat." Ned's neck was rigid with tension. For a moment he was so angry that he did not trust himself to speak. Littlefinger laughed. "I ought to make you sad, but that would be cruel. So have no fear, my good lord. For the sake of the love I bear for Catelyn, I will go to Janus Slint this very hour and make certain the city watch is yours. 6,000 gold pieces should do it. A third for the commander, a third for the officers, a third for the men. We might be able to buy them for half that much, but I prefer not to take chances." Smiling, he plucked up the dagger and offered it to Ned, hilt first. John. John was breaking his fast on apple cakes and blood sausage when Samuel Tarley plopped himself down on the bench.
"I've been summoned to the sept," Sam said in an excited whisper. "They're passing me out of training. I'm to be made a brother with the rest of you. Can you believe it?" "No, truly, truly. I'm to assist Maester Eamon with the library and the birds. He needs someone who can read and write letters."
"Oh, you'll do well at that," John said, smiling. Sam glanced about anxiously.
"Is it time to go? I shouldn't be late. They might change their minds."
He was fairly bouncing as they crossed the weed-strewn courtyard. The day was warm and sunny. Rivulets of water trickled down the sides of the wall, so the ice seemed to sparkle and shine. Inside the sept, the great crystal caught the morning light as it streamed through the south-facing window and spread it in a rainbow on the altar. Pip's mouth dropped open when he caught sight of Sam, and Toad poked Gren in the ribs, but no one dared say a word. Septon Celadar was swinging a censer, filling the air with fragrant incense that reminded John of Lady Stark's little sept in Winterfell. For once the Septon seemed sober. The high officers arrived in a body, Maester Aemon leaning on Clydus, Sir Alistair, cold-eyed and grim, Lord Commander Mormont, resplendent in a black wool doublet with silvered bear-claw fastenings. Behind them came the senior members of the three orders, Red-faced Bowen Marsh, the Lord Steward, First Builder Othel Jarvik, and Sir Jeremy Riker, who commanded the Rangers in the absence of Benjen Stark. Mormont stood before the altar, the rainbow shining on his bald head.
"You came to us outlaws," he began, "poachers, rapers, getters, killers and thieves. You came to us children. You came to us alone, in chains, with neither friends nor honour. You came to us rich, or you came to us poor. Some of you bear the names of proud houses, others have only bastards' names, or no names at all. It makes no matter. All that is past now. On the wall, we are all one house. At evenfall, as the sun sets, and we face the gathering night, you shall take your vows. From that moment, you will be a sworn brother of the Night's Watch. Your crimes will be washed away, your debts forgiven. So, too, you must wash away your former loyalties. Put aside your grudges. Forget old wrongs and old loves alike. Here, you'll begin anew. A man of the Night's Watch lives his life for the realm. Not for a king, nor a lord, nor the honour of this house or that house. Neither for gold, nor glory, nor a woman's love, but for the realm and all the people in it. A man of the Night's Watch takes no wife, and fathers no sons. Our wife is duty, our mistress is honour, and you are the only sons we shall ever know. You have learned the words of the vow. Think carefully before you say them. For once you have taken the black, there is no turning back. The penalty for desertion is death."
The old bear paused for a moment before he said,
"Are there any among you who wish to leave our company? If so, go now, and no one shall think the less of you."
No one moved.
"Well and good," said Mormont. "You may take your vows here, at evenfall, before Septon Celadar and the first of your order. Do any of you keep to the old gods?"
John stood. "I do, my lord."
"I expect you will want to say your words before a heart tree, as your uncle did,"
Mormont said. "Yes, my lord," John said. The gods of the sept had nothing to do with him. The blood of the first men flowed in the veins of the Starks. He heard Gren whispering beside him.
"There's no Godswood here, is there? I never saw a Godswood." You wouldn't see a herd of oryx until they trampled you into the snow. Pip whispered back. I would so, Gren insisted. I'd see them a long way off.
Mormont himself confirmed Gren's doubts.
Castle Black has no need of a godswood. Beyond the wall, the haunted forest stands as it stood in the Dawn Age, long before the Andals brought the Seven across the narrow sea. You will find a grove of weirwoods half a league from this spot, and mayhap your gods as well.
My lord!
The voice made John glance back in surprise. Samwell Tarly was on his feet. The fat boy wiped his sweaty palms against his tunic.
Might I go as well? To say my words at this art tree?
Does House Tarly keep the old gods too?
Mormont asked.
No, my lord,
Sam replied in a thin, nervous voice. The high officers frightened him, John knew, and the old bear most of all.
I was named in the Light of the Seven at the Sept on Horn Hill, as my father was, and his father, and all the Tidies for 1,000 years.
Why would you forsake the gods of your father and your house? Wondered Sir Jeremy Riker.
The Night's Watch is my house now, Sam said. The Seven have never answered my prayers. Perhaps the old gods will.
As you wish, boy, Mormont said.
Sam took his seat again, as did John.
We have placed each of you in an order as befits our need and your own strengths and skills.
Burnmarsh stepped forward and handed him a paper. The Lord Commander unrolled it and began to read.
Haldar, to the builders, he began.
Haldar gave a stiff nod of approval.
Gren, to the rangers. Albert, to the builders. Pippar, to the rangers.
Pip looked over at John and wiggled his ears.
Samwell, to the stewards.
Sam sagged with relief, mopping at his brow with a scrap of silk.
Mathor to the rangers, Darian to the Stuarts, Todda to the rangers, John to the Stuarts.
The Stuarts? For a moment John could not believe what he had heard. Mormont must have read it wrong. He started to rise to open his mouth to tell them there had been a mistake. And then he saw Sir Alistair studying him, eyes shiny as two flakes of obsidian, and he knew. The old bear rolled up the paper.
Your first will instruct you in your duties. May all the gods preserve you, brothers.
The Lord Commander favoured them with a half bow and took his leave. Sir Alistair went with him, a thin smile on his face. John had never seen the master-at-arms look quite so happy.
Rangers with me,
Sir Jeremy Riker called when they had gone. Pip was staring at John as he got slowly to his feet. His ears were red. Gren, grinning broadly, did not seem to realize that anything was amiss. Matt and Toad fell in beside them, and they followed Sir Jeremy from the Sept.
"Builders!"
announced lantern-jawed Uthel Yarwick. Haldar and Albeck trailed out after him. John looked around him in sick disbelief. Maester Aemon's blind eyes were raised towards the light he could not see. The Septon was arranging crystals on the altar. Only Sam and Darian remained on the benches, a fat boy, a singer, and him. Lord Steward Burnmarsh rubbed his plump hands together.
Samwell, you will assist Maester Aemon in the rookery and library. Chet is going to the kennels to help with the hounds. You shall have a cell so as to be close to the maester night and day. I trust we'll take good care of him. He's very old and very precious to us.
Darian, I am told that you sang at many a high lord's table and shared their meat and mead. We are sending you to East Watch. It may be your palate will be some help to Cutter Pike when merchant galleys come trading. We are paying too dear for salt beef and pickled fish, and the quality of the olive oil we've been getting has been frightful. Present yourself to Balkus when you arrive. He will keep you busy between ships.
Marsh turned his smile on John.
Lord Commander Mormont has requested you for his personal steward, John. You'll sleep in a cell beneath his chambers in the Lord Commander's tower.
And what will my duties be? John asked sharply. Will I serve the Lord Commander's meals, help him fasten his clothes, fetch hot water for his bath?
Certainly. Marsh frowned at John's tone. And you will run his messages, keep a fire burning in his chambers, change his sheets and blankets daily, and do all else that the Lord Commander might require of you.
Do you take me for a servant?
No,
Master Aemon said from the back of the sept. Clydus helped him stand.
We took you for a man of night's watch, but perhaps we were wrong in that.
It was all John could do to stop himself from walking out. Was he supposed to churn butter and sew doublets like a girl for the rest of his days?
May I go? He asked stiffly. As you wish,
Bowen Marsh responded. Darren and Sam left with him. They descended to the yard in silence. Outside, John looked up at the wall, shining in the sun. The melting ice, creeping down its side in 100 thin fingers. John's rage was such that he would have smashed it all in an instant, and the world be damned.
John, Samuel Tarley said excitedly, wait. Don't you see what they're doing?
John turned on him in a fury.
I see Sir Alice's bloody hand, that's all I see. He wanted to shame me, and he has.
Darien gave him a look.
The Stuarts are fine for the likes of you and me, Sam, but not for Lord Snow. I'm a better swordsman and a better rider than any of you, John blazed back. It's not fair.
Fair? Darien sneered. The girl was waiting for me, naked as the day she was born. She pulled me through the window. And you talk to me of fair?
He walked off.
There's no shame in being a Stuart, Sam said.
Do you think I want to spend the rest of my life washing an old man's small clothes?
The old man is Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, Sam reminded him. You'll be with him day and night. Yes, you'll pour his wine and see his bed linen is fresh, but you'll also take his letters, attend him at meetings, squire for him in battle. You'll be as close to him as his shadow. You'll know everything, be a part of everything. And the Lord Steward said Mormont asked for you himself. When I was little, my father used to insist that I attend him in the audience chamber whenever he held court. When he wrote to Highgarden to bend his knee to Lord Tyrell, he made me come. Later, though, he started to take Dickon and leave me at home, and he no longer cared whether I sat through his audiences, so long as Dickon was there. He wanted his heir at his side, don't you see? To watch and listen and learn from all he did. I'll wager that's why Lord Mormont requested you, John. What else could it be? He wants to groom you for command.
John was taken aback. It was true. Lord Eddard had often made Rob part of his councils back at Winterfell. Could Sam be right? Even a bastard could rise high in the Night's Watch, they said. I never asked for this, he said stubbornly.
None of us are here for asking, Sam reminded him.
And suddenly, John Snow was ashamed. Craven or not, Samuel Tarley had found the courage to accept his fate like a man. On the wall, a man gets only what he earns, Benjen Stark had said the last night John had seen him alive. You're no ranger, John. Only a green boy with the smell of summer still on you. He'd heard it said that bastards grow up faster than other children. On the wall, you grew up, or you died. John let out a deep sigh. You have the right of it. I was acting the boy.
Then you'll stay and say your words with me?
The old guards will be expecting us. He made himself smile. They set out late that afternoon. The wall had no gates as such, neither here at Castle Black, nor anywhere along its 300 miles.
They led their horses down a narrow tunnel cut through the ice, cold dark walls pressing in around them as the passage twisted and turned. Three times their way was blocked by iron bars, and they had to stop while Bowenmarsh drew out his keys and unlocked the massive chains that secured them. John could sense the vast weight pressing down on him as he waited behind the Lord Steward. The air was colder than a tomb, and more still. He felt a strange relief when they re-emerged into the afternoon light on the north side of the wall. Sam blinked at the sudden glare and looked round apprehensively.
The wildlings, they'd never dare come this close to the wall, would they?
They never have. John climbed into his saddle. When Bowenmarsh and their ranger escort had mounted, John put two fingers to his mouth and whistled. Ghosts came loping out of the tunnel. The Lord Steward's Garen wickered and backed away from the direwolf.
Do you mean to take that beast?
Yes, my lord, John said. Ghost's head lifted. He seemed to taste the air. In a blink of an eye, he was off, racing across the broad, weed-choked field to vanish in the trees. Once they had entered the forest, they were in a different world. John had often hunted with his father and Jorry and his brother Rob. He knew the wolf's wood around Winterfell as well as any man. The haunted forest was much the same, and yet the feel of it was very different. Perhaps it was all in the knowing. They had ridden past the end of the world. Somehow that changed everything. Every shadow seemed darker, every sound more ominous. The trees pressed close and shut out the light of the setting sun. A thin crust of snow cracked beneath the hooves of their horses with a sound like breaking bones. When the wind set the leaves to rustling, it was like a chilly finger tracing a path up John's spine. The wall was at their backs, and only the guards knew what lay ahead. The sun was sinking below the trees when they reached their destination. A small clearing in the deep of the wood, where nine werewoods grew in a rough circle. John drew in a breath, and he saw Sam Tarly staring. Even in the wolf's wood, you never found more than two or three of the white trees growing together. A grove of nine was unheard of. The forest floor was carpeted with fallen leaves, blood red on top, black rot beneath. The wide, smooth trunks were bone pale, and nine faces stared inward. The dried sap that crusted in the eyes was red and hard as ruby. Bowenmarsh commanded them to leave their horses outside the circle.
"This is a sacred place. We will not defile it."
When they entered the grove, Samwell Tarly turned slowly, looking at each face in turn. No two were quite alike.
"They're watching us," he whispered. "The old gods."
"Yes," John knelt, and Sam knelt beside him. They said the words together, as the last light faded in the west, and grey day became black night. "Hear my words and bear witness to my vow," they recited, their voices filling the twilight grove. "Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and my honor to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come." The woods fell silent. "You knelt as boys," Bowenmarsh intoned solemnly. "Rise now as men of the Night's Watch." John held out a hand to pull Sam back to his feet. The rangers gathered round to offer smiles and congratulations, all but the gnarled old forester, Dywin.
"Best we were starting back, my lord," he said to Bowen Marsh. "Dark's fallen, and there's something in the smell of the night that I mislike."
And suddenly, Ghost was back, stalking softly between two weirwoods. White fur and red eyes, John realized, disquieted. Like the trees. The wolf had something in his jaws. Something black.
"What's he got there?"
asked Bowen Marsh, frowning. "To me, Ghost." John knelt. "Bring it here." The dire wolf trotted to him. John heard Samuel Tarly's sharp intake of breath.
"Guards be good," Dywin muttered. "That's a hand."
Eddard. The grey light of dawn was streaming through his window when the thunder of hoofbeats awoke Eddard Stark from his brief, exhausted sleep. He lifted his head from the table to look down into the yard. Below, men in mail and leather and crimson cloaks were making the morning ring to the sound of swords and riding down mock warriors stuffed with straw. Ned watched Sandor Clegane gallop across the hard-packed ground to drive an iron-tipped lance through a dummy's head. Canvas ripped and straw exploded as Lannister guardsmen joked and cursed. "Is this brave show for my benefit?" he wondered. If so, Cersei was a greater fool than he'd imagined. "Damn her," he thought. "Why is the woman not fled? I've given her chance after chance." The morning was overcast and grim. Ned broke his fast with his daughters and Septa Mordain. Sansa, still disconsolate, stared sullenly at her food and refused to eat. But Arya wolfed down everything that was set in front of her. "Sirio says we have time for one last lesson before we take ship this evening," she said. "Can I, father? All my things are packed."
"A short lesson. Make certain you leave yourself time to bathe and change. I want you ready to leave by midday. Is that understood?"
"By midday," Arya said. Sansa looked up from her food. "If she can have a dancing lesson, why won't you let me say farewell to Prince Joffrey?"
"I would gladly go with her, Lord Eddard," Septa Mordain offered. "There would be no question of her missing the ship."
"It would not be wise for you to go to Joffrey right now, Sansa. I'm sorry." Sansa's eyes filled with tears. "But why?"
"Sansa, your lord father knows best," Septa Mordain said. "You are not to question his decisions."
"It's not fair." Sansa pushed back from her table, knocked over her chair, and ran weeping from the cellar. Septa Mordain rose, but Ned gestured her back to her seat. "Let her go, Septa. I will try to make her understand when we're all safely back in Winterfell." The Septa bowed her head and sat down to finish her breakfast. It was an hour later when Grand Maester Pycelle came to Eddard Stark in his cellar. His shoulder slumped, as if the weight of the great maester's chain around his neck had become too great to bear.
"My lord," he said, "King Robert is gone. The guards give him rest."
"No," Ned answered, "he hated rest. The guards give him love and laughter and the joy of righteous battle." It was strange how empty he felt. He had been expecting the visit. And yet with those words, something died within him. He would have given all his titles for the freedom to weep. But he was Robert's hand, and the hour he dreaded had come. "Be so good as to summon the members of the council here, to my solar," he told Pycelle. The Tower of the Hand was as secure as he and Tomard could make it. He could not say the same for the council chamber.
"My lord," Pycelle blinked, "surely the affairs of the kingdom will keep till the morrow, when our grief is not so fresh."
Ned was quiet but firm. "I fear we must convene at once." Pycelle bowed.
"As the hand commands."
He called his servants and sent them running, then gratefully accepted Ned's offer of a chair and a cup of sweet beer. Sir Barristan Selmy was the first to answer the summons, immaculate in white cloak and enamel scales.
"My lords," he said, My place is beside the young king now. Pray, give me leave to attend him.
Your place is here, Sir Barristan, Ned told him. Littlefinger came next. Still garbed in the blue velvets and silver mockingbird cape he had worn the night previous, his boots dusty from riding.
My lords, he said, smiling at nothing in particular before he turned to Ned, that little task you set me is accomplished, Lord Eddard.
Varys entered, in a wash of lavender, pink from his bath, his plump face scrubbed and freshly powdered, his soft slippers all but soundless.
The little birds sing a grievous song today, he said as he seated himself. The realm weeps. Shall we begin?
When Lord Renly arrives, Ned said, Varys gave him a sorrowful look.
I fear Lord Renly has left the city.
Left the city? Ned had counted on Renly's support.
He took his leave through a postern gate an hour before dawn, accompanied by Sir Loras Tyrell and some 50 retainers, Varys told them. When last seen, they were galloping south, in some haste, no doubt bound for Storm's End or High Garden.
So much for Renly and his 100 swords. Ned did not like the smell of that, but there was nothing to be done for it. He drew out Robert's last letter. The king called me to his side last night, and commanded me to record his final words. Lord Renly and Grand Maester Pycelle stood witness as Robert sealed the letter, to be opened by the council after his death. Sir Barristan, if you would be so kind. The Lord Commander of the King's Guard examined the paper. King Robert's seal and unbroken. He opened the letter and read,
Lord Eddard Stark is herein named Protector of the Realm, to rule as regent until the heir comes of age.
And as it happens, he is of age, Ned reflected. But he did not give voice to the thought. He trusted neither Pycelle nor Varys, and Sir Barristan was honour-bound to protect and defend the boy he thought his new king. The old knight would not abandon Joffrey easily. The need for a deceit was a bitter taste in his mouth. But Ned knew he must tread softly here. He must keep his counsel and play the game until he was firmly established as regent. There would be time enough to deal with the succession when Arya and Sansa were safely back in Winterfell, and Lord Stannis had returned to King's Landing with all his power. I would ask this council to confirm me as Lord Protector as Robert wished, Ned said, watching their faces, wondering what thoughts hid behind Pycelle's half-closed eyes, Littlefinger's lazy half-smile, and the nervous flutter of Varys's fingers. The door opened. Fat Tom stepped into the solar.
Pardon, my lords, the King's Steward insists.
The royal steward entered and bowed.
Esteemed lords, the King demands the immediate presence of his small council in the throne room.
Ned had expected Cersei to strike quickly. The summons came as no surprise.
The king is dead, he said. But we shall go with you, nonetheless. Tom, assemble an escort, if you would.
Littlefinger gave Ned his arm to help him down the steps. Varys, Pycelle, and Sir Barristan followed close behind. A double column of men-at-arms in chainmail and steel helms was waiting outside the tower, 8 strong. Grey cloaks snapped in the wind as the guardsmen marched them across the yard. There was no Lannister crimson to be seen, but Ned was reassured by the number of gold cloaks visible on the ramparts and at the gates. Jaina Slint met them at the door to the throne room, armoured in ornate black and gold plate, with a high-crested helm under one arm. The commander bowed stiffly. His men pushed open the great oaken doors, 20 feet tall and banded with bronze. The royal steward led them in.
All hail, His Grace, Joffrey of the Houses, Baratheon and Lannister, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, he sang out.
It was a long walk to the far end of the hall where Joffrey awaited atop the Iron Throne. Supported by Littlefinger, Ned Stark slowly limped
and hopped toward the boy who called himself King. The others followed. The first time he had come this way, he'd been on horseback, sword in hand, and the Targaryen dragons had watched from the walls as he forced Jaime Lannister down from the throne. He wondered if Joffrey would step down quite so easily. 5 knights of the King's Guard, all but Sir Jaime and Sir Barristan, were arrayed in a crescent around the base of the throne. They were in full armour, enamel steel from helm to heel, long pale cloaks over their shoulders, shining white shields strapped to their left arms. Cersei Lannister and her 2 younger children stood behind Sir Boros and Sir Meryn. The Queen wore a gown of sea-green silk, trimmed with Moorish lace, as pale as foam. On her finger was a golden ring with an emerald the size of a pigeon's egg, on her head a matching tiara. Above them, Prince Joffrey sat amongst the barbs and spikes in a cloth of gold doublet and a red satin cape. Sandor Clegane was stationed at the foot of the throne's steep, narrow stair. He wore mail and soot-grey plate and his snarling dog's-head helm. Behind the throne, 20 Lannister guardsmen waited, with long swords hanging from their belts. Crimson cloaks draped their shoulders, and steel lions crested their helms. But Littlefinger had kept his promise. All along the walls, in front of Robert's tapestries, with their scenes of hunt and battle, the gold-cloaked ranks of the city watch stood stiffly to attention, each man's hand clasped around the haft of an 8-foot-long spear tipped in black iron. They outnumbered the Lannisters 5-1. Ned's leg was a blaze of pain by the time he stopped. He kept a hand on Littlefinger's shoulder to help support his weight. Joffrey stood. His red satin cape was patterned in gold thread, 50 roaring lions to one side, 50 prancing stags to the other.
"I command the council to make all the necessary arrangements for my coronation," the boy proclaimed. "I wish to be crowned within the fortnight. Today I shall accept oaths of fealty for my loyal councillors."
Ned produced Robert's letter. "Lord Varys, be so kind as to show this to my Lady of Lannister." The eunuch carried the letter to Cersei. The Queen glanced at the words. "Protector of the realm," she read. "Is this meant to be your shield, my lord? A piece of paper?" She ripped the letter in half, ripped the halves into quarters, and let the pieces flutter to the floor.
"Those were the king's words," Sir Barristan said, shocked.
"We have a new king now," Cersei Lannister replied. "Lord Eddard, when last we spoke, you gave me some counsel. Allow me to return the courtesy." "Bend the knee, my lord. Bend the knee and swear fealty to my son, and we shall allow you to step down at hand and live out your days in the grey waste you call home." "Would that I could," Ned said grimly. If she was so determined to force the issue here and now, she left him no choice. "Your son has no claim to the throne he sits. Lord Stannis is Robert's true heir."
"Liar!"
Joffrey screamed, his face reddening.
"Mother, what does he mean?" Princess Marcella asked the Queen plaintively. "Isn't Joff the king now?"
"You condemn yourself with your own mouth, Lord Stark," said Cersei Lannister.
"Sir Barristan, seize this traitor." The Lord Commander of the King's Guard hesitated. In the blink of an eye, he was surrounded by Stark guardsmen, bare steel in their mailed fists. "And now the treason moves from words to deeds," Cersei said.
"Do you think Sir Barristan stands alone, my lord?"
With an ominous rasp of metal on metal, the hound drew his longsword. The knights of the King's Guard and 20 Lannister guardsmen in crimson cloaks moved to support him.
"Kill him!" the boy king screamed down from the iron throne. "Kill all of them! I command it!"
"You leave me no choice," Ned told Cersei Lannister. He called out to Jaina Slint. "Commander, take the Queen and her children into custody. Do them no harm, but escort them back to the royal apartments and keep them there under guard." "Men of the watch," Jaina Slint shouted, donning his helm. 100 gold cloaks leveled their spears and closed.
"I want no bloodshed," Ned told the Queen. "Tell your men to lay down their swords, and no one need—" With a single sharp thrust, the nearest gold cloak drove his spear into Tomard's back. Fat Tom's blade dropped from nerveless fingers as a wet red point burst out through his ribs, piercing leather and mail. He was dead before his sword hit the floor. Ned's shot came far too late. Janus Slint himself slashed open Varley's throat. Cain whirled, steel flashing, drove back the nearest spearman with a flurry of blows. For an instant it looked as though he might cut his way free. Then the hound was on him. Sandor Clegane's first cut took off Cain's sword hand at the wrist. His second drove him to his knees and opened him from shoulder to breastbone. As his men died around him, Littlefinger slid Ned's dagger from its sheath and shoved it up under his chin. His smile was apologetic. "I did warn you not to trust me, you know." Arya.
"Hey!"
Cyrio Forel called out, slashing at her head. The stick swords clacked as Arya parried.
"Left!" he shouted, and his blade came whistling. Hers darted to meet it. The clack made him click his teeth together. "Right," he said, "and low, and left again." Faster and faster, moving forward, Arya retreated before him, checking each blow. "Lunge," he warned.
And when he thrust, she sidestepped, swept his blade aside, and slashed at his shoulder. She almost touched him, almost, so close it made her grin. A strand of hair dangled in her eyes, limp with sweat. She pushed it away with the back of her hand.
"Left!" Cyril rang out. "Low!"
His sword was a blur, and the small hall echoed to the clack, clack, clack.
"Left! Left! Hey! Left! Right! Left! Low! Left!"
The wooden blade caught her high in the breast, a sudden, stinging blow that hurt all the more because it came from the wrong side.
"Ow!"
she cried out. She would have a fresh bruise there by the time she went to sleep, somewhere out at sea. "A bruise is a lesson," she told herself, "and each lesson makes us better." Cyrio stepped back.
"You are dead now."
Arya made a face.
"You cheated," she said hotly. "You said left, and you went right." "Just so. And now you are a dead girl."
"But you lied."
"My words lied. My eyes and my arm shouted out the truth, but you were not seen."
"I was, though," Arya said. "I watched you every second."
"Watching is not seeing, dead girl. The water dancer sees. Come, put down the sword. It is a time for listening now."
She followed him over to the wall, where he settled onto a bench.
"Cyrio Forel was first sword to the Sea Lord of Braavos, and are you known how that came to pass?"
"You were the finest swordsman in the city."
"Just so, but why? Other men were stronger, faster, younger. Why was Cyrio Forel the best? I will tell you now."
He touched the tip of his little finger lightly to his eyelid.
"The seeing, the true seeing, that is the heart of it. Hear me. The ships of Braavos sail as far as the winds blow, to land strange and wonderful, and when they return, their captains fetch queer animals to the Sea Lord's menagerie. Such animals as you have never seen. Striped horses, great spotted things with necks as long as stilts, hairy mouse pigs as big as cows, stinging manticores, tigers that carry their cubs in a pouch, terrible walking lizards with scythes for claws. Cyrio Forel has seen these things. On the day I am speaking of, the first sword was newly dead, and the Sea Lord sent for me. Many bravos had come to him, and as many had been sent away, none could say why. When I came into his presence, he was seated, and on his lap was a fat yellow cat. He told me that one of his captains had brought the beast to him from an island beyond the sunrise. 'Have you ever seen her like?' he asked of me. And to him I said, 'Each night in the alleys of the Braavos I see a thousand like him.' And the Sea Lord laughed, and that day I was named the first sword."
Arya screwed up her face. I don't understand. Sirio clicked his teeth together.
The cat was an ordinary cat, no more. The otters expected a fabulous beast, so that is what they saw. How large it was, they said. It was no larger than any other cat, only fat from indolence, for the Sea Lord fed it from his own table. What curious small ears, they said. Its ears had been chewed away in kitten fights, and it was plainly a tomcat. Yet the Sea Lord said, her, and that is what the others saw. Are you hearing?
Arya thought about it. You saw what was there.
Just so. Opening your eyes is all that is needed. The heart lies, and the head plays tricks with us. But the eyes see true. Look with your eyes, hear with your ears, taste with your mouth, smell with your nose, feel with your skin. Then comes the thinking afterward, and in that way knowing the truth.
Just so, said Arya, grinning. Sirio Forel allowed himself a smile.
I am thinking that when we are reaching this Winterfell of yours, it will be time to put this needle in your hand.
Yes, Arya said eagerly. Wait till I show John. Behind her, the great wooden doors of the small hall flew open with a resounding crash. Arya whirled. A knight of the King's Guard stood beneath the arch of the door, with five Lannister guardsmen arrayed behind him. He was in full armor, but his visor was up. Arya remembered his droopy eyes and rust-colored whiskers from when he had come to Winterfell with the king. Sir Meron Trent. The red cloaks wore mail shirts over boiled leather and steel caps with lion crests. Arya Stark, the knight said. Come with us, child. Arya chewed her lip uncertainly. What do you want? Your father wants to see you. Arya took a step forward, but Sirio Forel held her by the arm.
And why is it that Lord Eddard is sending Lannister men in the place of his own, I am wondering?
Mind your place, Dancing Master, Sir Meryn said. This is no concern of yours. My father wouldn't send you, Arya said. She snatched up her stick sword. The Lannisters laughed. Put down the stick, girl, Sir Meryn told her. I am a sworn brother of the King's Guard, the White Swords. So was the Kingslayer, when he killed the old king, Arya said. I don't have to go with you if I don't want. Sir Meryn Trant ran out of patience. Take her, he said to his men. He lowered the visor of his helm. Three of them started forward, chainmail clinking softly with each step. Arya was suddenly afraid. Fear cuts deeper than swords, she told herself, to slow the racing of her heart. Sirio Forel stepped between them, tapping his wooden sword lightly against his boot.
You will be stopping there. Are you men or dogs that you would threaten a child?
Out of the way, old man, one of the red cloaks said. Sirio's stick came whistling up and rang against his helm.
I am Sirio Forel, and you will now be speaking to me with more respect.
Bold bastard! The man yanked free his longsword. The stick moved again, blindingly fast. Arya heard a loud crack as the sword went clattering to the stone floor. My hand! The guardsman yelped, cradling his broken fingers. You are quick for a dancing master, said Sir Meryn.
You are slow for a knight, Sirio replied.
Kill the brave Ossie, and bring me the girl, the knight in the white armor commanded. Four Lannister guardsmen unsheathed their swords. The fifth, with the broken fingers, spat and pulled free a dagger with his left hand. Sirio Forel clicked his teeth together, sliding into his water dancer stance, presenting only his side to the foe.
Arya, child, he called out, never looking, never taking his eyes off the Lannisters. We are done with dancing for the day. Best you are going now. Run to your father.
Arya did not want to leave him, but he had taught her to do as he said. Swift as a deer, she whispered.
Just so, said Sirio Forel, as the Lannisters closed.
Arya retreated, her own sword stick clutched tightly in her hand. Watching him now, she realized that Sirio had only been toying with her when they dueled.
The red cloaks came at him from three sides with steel in their hands. They had chainmail over their chest and arms and steel codpieces sewn into their pants, but only leather on their legs. Their hands were bare, and the caps they wore had nose guards, but no visor over the eyes. Sirio did not wait for them to reach him, but spun to his left. Arya had never seen a man move so fast. He checked one sword with his stick and whirled away from a second. Off balance, the second man lurched into the first. Sirio put a boot to his back, and the red cloaks went down together. The third guard came leaping over them, slashing at the water dancer's head. Sirio ducked under his blade and thrust upwards. The guardsman fell screaming as blood welled from the wet red hole where his left eye had been. The fallen men were getting up. Sirio kicked one in the face and snatched the steel cap off the other's head. The dagger man stabbed at him. Sirio caught the thrust in the helmet and shattered the man's kneecap with his stick. The last red cloak shouted a curse and charged, hacking down with both hands on his sword. Sirio rolled right, and the butcher's cut caught the helmetless man between neck and shoulders as he struggled to his knees. The long sword crunched through mail and leather and flesh. The man on his knees shrieked. Before his killer could wrench free his blade, Sirio jabbed him in the apple of his throat. The guardsman gave a choked cry and staggered back, clutching at his neck, his face blackening. Five men were down, dead or dying by the time Arya reached the back door that opened on the kitchen. She heard some Meran trance curse. "Bloody oaths," he swore, drawing his longsword from its scabbard. Sirio Forel resumed his stance and clicked his teeth together. "Arya, child," he called out, never looking at her. "Be gone now." "Look with your eyes," he had said. She saw. The knight, in his pale armor, head to foot, legs, throat, and hands sheathed in metal, eyes hidden behind his high white helm, and in his hand cruel steel. Against that, Sirio, in a leather vest, with a wooden sword in his hand. "Sirio, run," she screamed.
"The first sword of bravest does not run," he sang as Sir Meran slashed at him. Sirio danced away from his cut, his stick a blur. In a heartbeat, he had bounced blows off the knight's temple, elbow, and throat, the wood ringing against the metal of helm, gauntlet, and gorget. Arya stood frozen. Sir Meran advanced. Sirio backed away. He checked the next blow, spun away from the second, deflected the third. The fourth sliced his stick in two, splintering the wood and shearing through the lead core. Sobbing, Arya spun and ran. She plunged through the kitchens and buttery, blind with panic, weaving between cooks and potboys. A baker's helper stepped in front of her, holding a wooden tray. Arya bowled her over, scattering fragrant loaves of fresh-baked bread on the floor. She heard shouting behind her as she spun around, a portly butcher who stood gaping at her with a cleaver in his hand. His arms were red to the elbow. All that Sirio Forel had taught her went racing through her head. Swift as a deer, quiet as a shadow, fear cuts deeper than swords, quick as a snake, calm as still water, fear cuts deeper than swords, strong as a bear, fierce as a wolverine, fear cuts deeper than swords. The man who fears losing has already lost. Fear cuts deeper than swords. Fear cuts deeper than swords. Fear cuts deeper than swords. The grip of her wooden sword was slick with sweat, and Arya was breathing hard when she reached the turret stair. For an instant she froze, up or down. Up would take her to the covered bridge that spanned the small court to the Tower of the Hand, but that would be the way they'd expect her to go, for certain. "Never do what they expect," Sirio once said. Arya went down, around and around, leaping over the narrow stone steps, two and three at a time. She emerged in a cavernous, vaulted cellar, surrounded by casks of ale, stacked 20 feet tall. The only light came through narrow, slanting windows high in the wall. The cellar was a dead end. There was no way out but the way she had come in. She dare not go back up those steps. But she couldn't stay here, either.
She had to find her father and tell him what had happened. Her father would protect her. Arya thrust her wooden sword through her belt and began to climb, leaping from cask to cask until she could reach the window. Grasping the stone with both hands, she pulled herself up. The wall was 3 foot thick. The window, a tunnel, slanting up and out. Arya wriggled toward daylight. When her head reached ground level, she peered across the bailey to the Tower of the Hand. The stout wooden door hung splintered and broken, as if by axes. A dead man sprawled face down on the steps, his cloak tangled beneath him, the back of his mail shirt soaked red. The corpse's cloak was grey wool, trimmed with white satin, she saw with sudden terror. She could not tell who he was.
No, she whispered. What was happening? Where was her father? Why had the red cloaks come for her? She remembered what the man with the yellow beard had said, the day she had found the monsters. If one hand can die, why not a second? Arya felt tears in her eyes. She held her breath to listen. She heard the sounds of fighting, shouts, screams, the clang of steel on steel, coming through the windows of the Tower of the Hand. She could not go back. Her father... Arya closed her eyes. For a moment, she was too frightened to move. They had killed Jory and Will and Hewitt, and that guardsman on the steps, whoever he had been. They could kill her father, too, and her if they caught her. Fear cuts deeper than swords, she said aloud. But it's no good pretending to be a water dancer. Syrio had been a water dancer, and the White Knight had probably killed him. And anyhow, she was only a little girl with a wooden stick, alone and afraid. She squirmed out into the yard, glancing around warily as she climbed to her feet. The castle seemed deserted. The Red Keep was never deserted. All the people must be hiding inside, their doors barred. Arya glanced up longingly at her bedchamber, then moved away from the Tower of the Hand, keeping close to the wall as she slid from shadow to shadow. She pretended she was chasing cats, except she was the cat now, and if they caught her, they would kill her. Moving between buildings and over walls, keeping stone to her back whenever possible, so as no one could surprise her, Arya reached the stables almost without incident. A dozen gold cloaks in mail and plate ran past as she was edging across the inner bailey, but without knowing whose side they were on, she hunched down low in the shadows and let them pass. Holland, who had been master of horse at Winterfell as long as Arya could remember, was slumped on the ground by the stable door. He had been stabbed so many times, it looked as if his tunic was patterned with scarlet flowers. Arya was certain he was dead. But when she crept closer, his eyes opened.
"Arya Underfoot," he whispered, "you must warn your lord father."
Frothy red spittle bubbled from his mouth. The master of horse closed his eyes again and said no more. Inside were more bodies, a groom she had played with, and three of her father's household guard. A wagon, laden with crates and chests, stood abandoned near the door of the stable. The dead men must have been loading it for the trip to the docks when they were attacked. Arya snuck closer. One of the corpses was Desmond, who'd shown her his longsword and promised to protect her father. He lay on his back, staring blindly at the ceiling as flies crawled across his eyes. Close to him was a dead man in the red cloak and lion-crest helm of the Lannisters. Only one, though. "Every Northerner is worth 10 of these Southern swords," Desmond had told her. "You liar," she said, kicking his body in a sudden fury. The animals were restless in their stalls, wickering and snorting at the scent of blood. Arya's only plan was to saddle a horse and flee, away from the castle and the city. All she had to do was stay on the King's Road, and it would take her back to Winterfell. She took a bridle and harness off the wall. As she crossed in back of the wagon, a fallen chest caught her eye. It must have been knocked down in the fight or dropped as it was being loaded. The wood had split, the lid opening to spill the chest contents across the ground. Arya recognized silks and satins and velvets she never wore. She might need warm clothes.